Thomas Glave is only one of a handful of black writers who have won the prestigious O. Henry Award for fiction. His debut collection of short stories, Whose Song and Other Stories, published by City Lights, has been widely acclaimed. Glave's lyrical style challenges language, and his stories convey the experiences of voices rarely heard. He has written extensively from his point of view as a black man, a gay man, a New Yorker, and a Jamaican. He is also an assistant professor of literature and rhetoric at New York's Binghamton University and helped found the Jamaican Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays. I met Glave on a sunny day in San Francisco. As an activist, writer, and teacher, I wanted to know what he thought about gay activism in America post 9/11 and how many voices of dissent have been noticeably silent. One voice that formed the basis for our discussion was Arundhati Roy, the Indian activist and novelist. Her essay, The Algebra of Infinite Justice, was widely distributed after September 11th. In the essay, Roy says America is fighting a war against a people it doesn't know because it doesn't see them on television. And she says, America is terribly ignorant of the history that led up to 9/11.
I think that Arundhati Roy is a highly essential voice right now for gay and lesbian people, for queer people everywhere, especially in this country at this moment, because she is enunciating a political analysis that we need to pay attention to in its geopolitical focus and gaze, I think, certainly, but also the ways in which she addresses U.S. injustice, hegemony, violence against all of these countries that are embroiled in the geopolitical situation that we're facing right now, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, and so on, Israel certainly, Palestine, goodness knows, we know right now, Afghanistan, very much at the core of a lot of these battles. And she's giving an alternative view. She's talking about, she's surpassing, she's superseding the nationalist and national rhetoric that I think we're hearing a lot of in this country right now, much of which has to do with people's emotional raw responses to what they see as the terrible outrage that has no historical precedent of September 11th, because they're looking with a very ahistorical gaze at those events and not seeing how they came out of a sequence of injustices and outrages against people in that part of the world, what we call the Middle East. And what I'm concerned about right now in the U.S. with some of the gay press, and I spoke to some people recently about the problems with what I see in some of the gay so-called mainstream, more popular press like Out Magazine and The Advocate, is that they're not engaging in sustained, really critical dialogues about these very complicated politics and outcomes of the 11th. People are responding in those places largely emotionally to the heroics, and we get that as a narrative term, the heroics, the survival, and so on. Well, all that's true, but some of it reminds me of what we saw on CNN in the early days covering September 11th, the sort of narrative things that sprung up immediately, like America under attack, or America rising, or America's new war. Those narrative titles, those rubrics, kind of become sort of these encapsulating devices that truncate thought into very codified and simplistic formulae that people can then react to and say, oh yes, America's new war, or terror under management, or whatever. But she's exploding a lot of that stuff and saying, well, no, we need to look at the fact that the U.S. leveled sanctions against Iraq for years, which led to the genocide of children, that the U.S. caused all kinds of problems in the Sudan. We need to look at also things like the moves of some corporations now, like Monsanto, for example, toward privatizing water, an essential resource. I mean, you can't be queer without water. That's a fact, right? You can't be gay or lesbian without water. You can't live without water. And I think that these are all issues which concern all of us as gay and lesbian, queer, whatever we call ourselves, people. These are human rights issues. And I think that oftentimes we bracket ourselves into a particular way of looking at our issues as this is a gay issue or isn't a gay issue. So we'll think about don't ask, don't tell as a gay lesbian issue. But we won't think about it as a human issue that is human in the way that, say, immigration rights are human and also gay and lesbian, because there are lots of queer immigrants who are affected by immigration policies. We need more of a global, more nuanced, more discriminating perspective to really look at the fine points.
How does one rally gays and lesbians across the country to move into what they have typically seen as the issues that most affect them and what many of them perceive as basic rights, like gay marriage, gay adoption, those kinds of things, and blend them into more social issues?
Well, Brian, you know, I think that just in your question, you bring up a point. One of the problems when we talk about gays and lesbians marshalling across the country around issues or beyond issues that they think have traditionally concerned them, like, as you say, gay marriage or gay adoption. Because for a lot of us who come from different communities who are gay and lesbian, police brutality, for example, in black communities, in Vietnamese communities, in Latino communities, right, in Native American communities, police brutality is an issue. Environmental racism is an issue. Toxic waste dumping on Native American reservations. Now, there are gay and lesbian people who are part of these populations, who live in these areas. So for us, I can think, you know, to give you a personal example, that when I walk down the street on a daily basis, I'm probably going to be thinking more about the fact that I might be shot by the police at any minute, or hauled into a squad car, or followed around in a store as a black person, because that's what people see first, is my skin. So whether I'm seen as a faggot by them or not, ultimately is really quite secondary or even tertiary. But what they see first is my skin. And similarly, if we're living in abject housing conditions, if we don't have access to medical care and good education, if we don't have health insurance, if we don't have access to safe prenatal care, to safe abortions, things like this, these are concerns that come up for a lot of us before things like gay marriage or gay adoption.
You're listening to a conversation with the author Thomas Glave on This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Brian Goble. Shortly after September 11th, Glave was inspired to write a poem, which will be published next year in the Kenyon Review.
This piece is called Interview with the Knot Poem, and it was written almost entirely in one sitting on September 21st, 2001. The piece really was a response to not only what happened in September, but to some underlying things that have long been really present in this country, maybe principally xenophobia, and the ways in which xenophobia manifests itself in various bigotries. Interview with the Knot Poem. Interviewer. But how can you call yourself a knot poem? You look, from all appearances, like a poem. You crouch, shuffle, swing and sway, and arrange your lines, syllables, metaphors and similes, like a poem. Your flesh resembles that of a poem, of all poems, as do all your other parts. So how, pray tell, can you not be a poem? Explain, if you will, this not poemness, this state of un. Not poem. But then, do not call me a poem, for no, I am not one. I came recently from that country, about which by now you surely will have heard, in which it was most unwise, ungood, simply un, to be a poem. Entire poems were murdered in silent fields. Stanzas, though begging for their lives, their limbs, were strung up and destroyed. Delicate lines and vulgar ones, those both insensitive to light and fond of it, and even mere epithets, cries in ignorance and mediocrity, simple daily failure, but also joy, were torched, leaving only ashes, bare ashes, in their wake. Erased unto oblivion, scratched out of paper villages, books unimaginable, books that, though outlawed, were somewhere dreamt. The smell of burning poem flesh, rancid, sooty, and profane, shrouded entire cities, coastal plains. Poem conversations were spied on by poem-despising agents, and entire towns of poems emptied, laid waste, rounded up and deported, torched, as I said, stoned. So no, do not call me a poem. I will never be a poem again. Interviewer. But still, you do look much like a poem, and sound like one. You smell... not poem. But then, you know nothing, I see, of the flags that, in that time, so swiftly, were raised. Raised within days. Yes. Raised over 20 million roofs, hoisted high over 100 million TV antennas. Flags, proud flags, flaggery everywhere. Flags raised against poems and those who resembled them. Flags sprouted in airports, especially in airports, at all security points, on all customs checks. Proof of citizenship so critical, fealty more so. But flags, too, in previously bland shopping malls and across yawning suburban lawns. Poems dared not walk unaccompanied to the market, nor, no, not ever, to worship and poem holy places. Poems were wrenched off planes by those too edgy to fly with them. Who knows? They could be one of them, some shouted, teeth bared but shoulders cowering. Rocks in their dreams, if not yet in their hands. For, yes, did you not know? Poem children began ducking stones at school, and more than one poem, or anyone who looked like one, was felled by bullets. Bullets, the good old-fashioned kind that still served. Better than the national pastime, and more to the point. Bullets still good enough to bring down a dirty poem, to blow the heads off poem motherfuckers who should anyway have had the sense, long ago, to go back where they came from. Dirty poems, cocksucking poems, poems that didn't speak the language, that chattered only in an outlandish gibberish, poems that stole jobs and their dreams, those elusive dreams, the dream, poems that flooded the nation, bred like rabbits. Poems that fucked with life as they knew it. Poems that prayed too much or too little, always with those awful accents, that savage garb. Poems without flags. The flag. Bullets urged on by flags that stated, loudly, this is who I am and what I believe. And you, they asked, who are you? Interviewer, do you actually expect us to believe? Not poem. Only that I am a not poem, not a poem. Interviewer, but you've said that flags were used to not poem. Oh, but let me tell you. They believed in their flag, its supposed nobility, its invincibility. Is not a flag, though it may blare loudly enough, its share of red, easier to gaze upon, caress? Than 1 million and counting scorched hands in a field, than 60 million legs and limbs suspended between leaves, than 200,000 eyes peering outward from crouching hoods, than deserts baked with dead poems and with fingers, knees. A flag doesn't answer back, after all. It makes no pretensions to having a right to its own life. It couldn't care less about hunger or thirst. It loves bombs, which inform the songs droned out routinely in its name. It drapes coffins at will and with grace. And most of all, yes, most important, it adores histories that never were, that were never taught, known, and will never be. Not history. Interviewer. And so the poems... Not poem. In that place, the poems ran to the hills and hid. All bets are off, someone said. Only not poems will live now. That is what they said. And so we transformed ourselves. Yes, our faces and our hands. We quickly grew 6 fingers and 3 eyes. We covered our mouths with clever lines from novels penned by dilettantes. We made the stanza merely a memory while retaining allegory. We scaled the walls where freedom, once advertised, no longer stretched. We ceased worshiping in all the poem holy places. We replaced God with the flag for freedom's sake. Interviewer, and so now you... Not poem. Now I am a not poem, still fearful of bullets. Uncertain of my lines, content with no plot. The plot, they were certain, beneath their flag, we all possessed. Their darkest dream, a poem, any poem, the unending line.
Thomas Glaive is the author of Whose Song and Other Stories, published by City Lights. Interview with the Knot Poem will be published by the Kenyon Review in 2003. For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goble in San Francisco.